Okay. Thank you everyone for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Randall Wright, who'll be speaking with us this hour. So Randall is Program Director at MIT's Office of Corporate Relations. This interview is an element of IRI's digitalization community. Through the DXC, you can access case studies and white papers with fresh, relevant content. A conference dedicated to digitalization, that's Digital Futures, and it's being held in Cleveland, Ohio at Case Western Reserve University on October 11th through the 13th. We also have facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics. If you'd like an invitation, let me know. Updates with additional insights and resources, and webinar interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. These always take place on the third Thursday of the month at 12 p.m. Eastern, except for next month when we will be taking a vacation. And by we, I mean I. I'll be sure to sign all of you up for updates to the DXC if you haven't already received them. And if you don't want to receive updates, just let me know. A few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin the conversation. First, this session is being recorded, and you will get a link to the recording. And we will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will not be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can type your questions into the chat to me or generally, and I'll read it out for you, or you can unmute yourself and turn your camera on and join us for a conversation. All right, let's get started. Randall, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. Very happy to speak with all of you today and have a discussion that we can have about innovation and universities and innovation communities.
All right. Awesome. So, tell us about your background and your work at MIT.
Sure. Well, I have been at MIT for over 30 years, working with executives. And my role at MIT is really to advise, counsel, and direct the exploration that executives make of the work at MIT. So, the MIT ILP program, which is really is goes back almost 70 years now, is a program that enables executives to come and learn about advances going on at MIT. Prior to being here, I was a strategic planning analyst at Pennzoil Company and then later a marketing manager advisor, but that was in a material science division advisor at the time. I graduated from MIT with a Master of Science in Metallurgy and have an MBA from the University of Chicago. And I always found it very interesting to me about what makes MIT tick, because it always seemed to be something that was very hard to put your finger on. And so I guess that is what kept me interested in what was going on. So I've always found throughout my career, every year I've learned something new about business, people, innovation. It's been really a marvelous experience.
That's awesome. It sounds like they keep you on your toes.
Yeah, it does. A lot of people here to do that and also in business. So, yeah, it's been interesting.
Right. So we all know that digital technologies are a huge disruptor for industries. And you've written extensively in our journal, RTM, and you've talked about how to stay ahead. In order to stay ahead, companies need to do reconnaissance. And can you explain what that is and how that works and how that relates to what you do?
Sure. I'm going to preface it by saying something that was said by Lester Thoreau. Since we're talking about digital technologies, Lester Thoreau was an economist at Sloan School. And, about 25, 30 years ago, I remember him saying this. He said, in 1500, you would measure wealth as gold. He said, in the 1700s, you measure wealth and you start measuring wealth as production assets. He said, increasingly, we will measure wealth as the ability to control information. And that's the big thing, because that's what digital technologies really are about, is about information, control of information. When Thoreau said this, there was no Google and there were no smartphones. So he was very prescient in his remarks. Now, when we talk about reconnaissance, this is actually something I learned from a company when I first came to MIT. I learned it from the Timken company. But to explain it, I'm going to use I was looking at a book that I had called Dynamic Business Strategy that goes back to when I was in business school. And the author of it, Theodore Smith, said, I'm just going to read this because it really highlights why you want to do reconnaissance. He said, companies tend to respond to gradual changes in the outer world in the same manner.
Sorry, Randall, I accidentally muted you for a second when I was trying to mute someone else.
Okay. So,
would you mind reading that out again? My apologies.
We'll do that. I'm happy to do
that. I'm sorry.
From the book Dynamic Business Strategy from the University of Chicago. It said, companies tend to respond to gradual changes in the outer world in the same manner as life forms do. And if they have no mechanism to enable them to understand the significance of their adaptation, like the dinosaurs, they will pass away. Yet this need not happen. So long as a company's resource values are not seriously impaired, and so long as the company is capable of evaluating the significance of change, it can survive. But survival is not automatic. There must be a strategy for dealing with trends and with changes in trends in the outside world. It's been said that the same three Chinese characters denote danger as denote opportunity. Environmental dynamics can offer gains to those prepared to act strategically. Even dangers can be minimized by having understanding of the points of vulnerability of an enterprise and of the forces which act on those points. That's really the case for doing reconnaissance. And let me explain. Many years ago, I had really the privilege of working with the Timken Company as a member of the ILP program. The Timken Company makes bearings. And in the late 1980s, early 90s, they were concerned, as most businesses were, with Japanese competition. And it turned out, it became clear to Timken that their Japanese competitors were approaching them in quality. And Timken wanted to be able to be a supplier to Toyota. And back in those days, that was very difficult to be able to qualify to be a supplier to a Japanese company. So these were big ambitions. They had a small team of executives who would visit MIT. And they were frankly very good at speaking to just about anybody. And they would listen to any suggestion one might make to say, why don't you look here or talk to this person or this other person looks interesting. And from that, the man who was the vice president of research, he later became the CEO, Bob Leibensberger, led a small group of executives who would visit MIT regularly, but report back to the senior management. And this way, they were able to identify people, resources, what Smith, who wrote this book, calls trends. I would say movements more so. And in that way, they were able to adapt the company. It turned out that Computer World said that they were one of the best companies in using information technology. And this was in like the early 1990s. So it's through that reconnaissance that they did, that they were able to learn what's going on. One of the things that I see with companies that I think that they should realize is that at a university, the reason to go there is really to find out what people are doing. And to also realize that there are people doing research work in fields that may be peripheral, but may be important to your company, just as I've read in the book, a change in the outside world. And they're going to do it whether you're there or not. They're going to be inventing things and creating things whether you participate or not. So the first thing to do is to find out what are they talking about and why are they doing what they're doing. There's a tendency, I think, for people, and one would see this in looking at an economics book. So if you look at an economics book and it says technology, it's all related to production. It's not related to changing the market or creating demand. All technologies, certainly I see at MIT, somebody invents something, but then the reason they're working with that is because it will have a big impact on how people live. And that's like the demand part. So as an example of something like that, when Samuel Morse invented the telegraph, he was a very religious man. And the first message he telegraphed to his brother was, "What hath God wrought?" because he realized this would change everything. It killed off the Pony Express. Commerce changed completely. The railroads used telegraph, you know, to manage all of their activities. Banking changed. Businesses arose that were telecommunications business. That's what AT&T means, right? American telegraph and telephone. So, you know, when you visit a university, what you want to find out is, why are they doing this? And what is the impact on society? Because that's what's driving the research. That's why you have to do reconnaissance. And that's why I would recommend to people that it's okay to have a list of needs, but I would say, put the needs aside, find out what people are doing, and then go back and look at the needs, because that your appreciation for what the capability the company has to create or develop may be very different once you start finding out what other people are doing. So reconnaissance means team of people, they come in, they assess not just the technology, why are people doing what they're doing, and also get names. Okay, so this is like, the reason you want names is because technology development is very human and it has fingerprints. And so you want to find the people to follow who are developing things, because if you watch where they're headed, you have a really great prediction on the future. So those are just some pointers.
So what are some ways that companies can connect with these innovation communities, these passionate people? That's, and walk around, see who's talking, you know?
Well, that's a very good question. And I say this is a good question for a little bit different reason. One of the issues that arises with open innovation that I've seen is that open innovation, I think, is appealing to companies because it seems like shopping. So by the language people use and the way they talk, they start to cast themselves in the role of a customer. Give you an example. I read a guide that was produced by an organization about what universities needed to do for a site visit. You know, so a site visit means people, okay. And what kind of language does it use? Well, it talks about showcasing. The university showcasing something. That's sales talk. Showcase means like you went to a jewelry store. That's a showcase. It's not talking about your role has to be to integrate with these communities, to understand what they're talking about, to really appreciate where things are going. So let me give you an example of why I'm saying this. Many years ago, I brought an executive to speak to Bill Mitchell, who was the head of architecture at the time at MIT. And the Media Lab reported to architecture. It's part of the Department of Architecture. And Bill Mitchell had one of the very first iPhones. Nobody had, you know, it was on TV, but people didn't have. That's all he had on his desk was an iPhone. And he began talking about how this would change the world. And with gravitas, he ended the conversation by saying, "This changes everything." And we got up and we left the meeting, and the executive pulled me aside and said, "I have no idea what he was talking about." Okay, the point is that this executive didn't really get on the same wavelength as Bill Mitchell was on. There is a faculty member at, what I'm saying is you can't be a customer who wants to be waited on and is looking for deals. What you want to try to do is integrate into the community that's creating something. As an example, I remember there was a food company that we worked with a few years ago who was interested in farm to table. So as we did some investigation, because they wanted to make their food more like farm to table, turns out farm to table started in a restaurant in San Francisco with a small group of very obsessed people about farm to table ingredients. And the point is, unless you understand what they're talking about, you would never really be able to grasp what the movement was about. Sandy Pentland here at MIT has written a book that was called Social Physics. Social physics says that there is another means of communication we have that is not verbal and it's not writing. It's our affect. It's how we look at each other. Sandy said a very interesting thing. He said, the reason you and I can have a conversation is because I'm completing or you're completing my sentences. So you know when to speak. So that's an example of social physics. That's very intrinsic to when people start talking about technology and how it will change the world. So, and this has been very much studied. This is not, you know, just talking. So when you are going to meet a community that's innovating, it's very important to try to fit in with what and try to appreciate, what did they mean? What are they saying? Can I reconstruct really the arguments they're making? Because people are making arguments about the future. You know, for example, take a different example. The Democrats, Joe Biden, Build Back Better. That's an argument for how the world ought to change, how we can make America better. If you're a Build Back Better guy, you get it. But if you're outside of that world, you don't know what they're talking about. So that's why you really want to try to understand what people mean. Another example I'd give you is something like Twitter. I'm the last person to talk to anybody about Twitter because I cannot imagine why anybody would want to spend time either reading or type, but obviously it's a very important thing. So if you're going to have, say, Twitter is going to be part of our future, you really have to talk to the Twitter people to really grasp what they're talking about because they know where it's headed. And so, you know, the people, you've said that they are passionate. They're not passionate, they're obsessed. The French have a saying that the definition of obsession is when everything has been said about a topic that can be said and somebody keeps talking. You know? So for some researchers, you know, what they're doing is their life. I mean, it's so important to them. So it's very important to be able to understand what kind of world are they conceiving of? And can I appreciate what they're doing in the direction they're headed in? That's extremely valuable information in planning for the future. So again, you want to be able to connect almost like visceral with the people you're speaking with and not be a customer. And also not, I don't think you want to visit a university and look for a session like with a psychologist so that you're busy, you know, talking. I remember many years ago, there was a couple of guys from a company and they were talking to a professor at Sloan School. And everything he said, they said, well, we can't do this, we can't do this. They had all kinds of issues in the company. And he said, finally, he said, it doesn't matter what I'm saying, because whatever I'm talking about, you're finding a reason why it won't work. Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is find out what are people doing. And you know, a KPI, or a critical key performance indicator for a company is how much time do you spend talking about yourself? And how much time are you engaged with what the other people are talking about? People do better when they engage with where are they going? What are they headed towards? So those are just some observations after many years.
So who in the company do you think should be doing this reconnaissance? Like who did Timken send in back then?
That's really a good question. The kind of person you have to have, see, this is a really critical thing. Let's say it this way. The person you have to send in should know the company very well and also understand the company's policies and business strategy. So when I'm saying policies, this is what I mean. I don't mean formal policies in that sense. Bruce Henderson, who had founded the Boston Consulting Group, had said, companies have like hundreds or thousands of policies that are unwritten. It's how we do business. All right, so what you want is somebody who really understands sort of the culture of the business. For example, there is a firm I was just talking to, a very famous company, but they said to me, the way decisions are made is collectively in the company, that there are small groups of executives who agree and then they proceed. So it isn't one guy making a decision. And by contrast to that, I remember the story about this electronic Singer sewing machine. And this was told to me by a man named John Ritz many years ago. Singer created a sewing machine that had electronics in it, set what the stitches were. And the marketing people were trying to figure out what to sell it for. And the CEO came in and said, if we can't sell it for $1,000, we shouldn't sell it. Well, then that was the price decision. He was one guy. But in this other company, that kind of decision would never be made. So first of all, do you know the policies or the culture? Do you know how they make money, what the business strategy is? You want a person like that who also can then have input into what should the strategy be. What a company sometimes does is they will send in people who are technical specialists who have no connection to the senior executives. So they come in and they say, they want to look at all kinds of engineering, and it's okay, but they're not looking at the bigger picture of capability development. They're trying to optimize things in the company. That isn't adequate for, that's not reconnaissance. I liken it in an article that I wrote for IRI, just send in the chiefs. You know, if you go on an aircraft carrier, the chiefs know the boat. That's what they say, the chiefs run the Navy. They know everything about what works, what doesn't work, and all the technicalities, but they don't know where the boat is going. Above the flight deck, well, then there are reconnaissance officers who are going out saying what they're spotting out there that the boat is going to have to respond to. All of those, it's interesting, the commanding officer of an aircraft carrier has to be a pilot. He has to be somebody who actually has been a pilot, who understands that activity, and he's sending out pilots. You want people who are going to have the bigger picture on the company, because the developments that occur certainly at a place like MIT will cause people to have to change their business strategies or adapt to it, just as I mentioned previously. So that's who should be doing it.
So once think you've got the right team, you talked about, don't show up as a customer, don't think you're going to go shopping. What are some other best practices that you think work for working with universities, particularly MIT?
Okay, that's a great question. And I'm going to back up a little bit on your question. I hope you won't mind what I'm going to say about best practices. Okay, when people speak about best practices, they mean things they should do, okay? And I would say, I think people want to back up and say, what are the fundamentals I should know and go from that? So, because what I'm saying is, if I gave people a list of stuff, that's not saying why you would want to do something. There's a reason why you don't want to be a customer. And it's because a customer isn't predisposed to the real hard thinking they're going to have to do to appreciate what they're seeing. They're going to be leaving that to somebody else. Or for example, I remember Jay Popp is a consultant who teaches a wonderful course called Technology Scouting Masterclass. I was asked to speak in one of his classes, and he had about 40 people there. And he asked them, he said, how many of you are evaluated by the number of deals you start? And so like half the class raised their hands, and he said, well, your real role is to bring back information. It's not to be signing up projects, it's to bring back information. So if we're going to talk about best practices, we want to talk about what's the right role. Your role has to be almost like a graduate student wanting to start a thesis. That's how it's done. Is at MIT, you take classes, but you have to do experiments, you have to do original work. And the way you do that is you go out and you talk to people in the community and you find out what are people doing, what's the latest thinking. Let's find a really important problem to solve. And that's what you're really trying to do. The company is trying to think, what practices should we develop? Some things you should do: visit frequently, which is like a few times a year. You should be willing to explore widely. A lot of times people's investigation is too narrow. As an example, companies used to be in industries. So there were industries, and consultants would have industry practices. increasingly what we see is what we call domains. That is to say, people have, this was identified by Arnoldo Hacks at Sloan School many years ago. What he said is that, and he was responding really to Michael Porter's strategy books, in which Hacks was saying that information technology would change business strategy. And he said, ultimately, you know, he was saying, you have complementers. What is he talking? He's talking like Bill Ford talks today. Bill Ford says he's not in the car business. He's in the mobility business. And there are innovations that are occurring outside of what was the car business. He said many years ago, the innovations all occurred in a very contained automobile world. Now it's much broader. So you want to be able to investigate broadly, because the technologies, you know, we speak of digitization. The problem with a lot of these digital technologies is that, and a competitor can emerge somewhere or somebody in your domain, and they don't have to build a plant to do it. They can emerge in some way where they're controlling some piece of information, and you don't want to be commoditized. That's why you have to explore broadly. You need to have more than one person visiting. Here's why. You have to reconstruct what you think somebody's saying and to see, does everybody really catch on to what this person is talking about, how this technology is supposed to change how people live? And that means people hear different things, even in the same conversation. So explore broadly, and then you have to debrief at home. And actually, some companies are really good at keeping records of who they spoke to and what was said that they can go back and refer to. And you want this to be information that people assess back as to, well, what's our business strategy like? How are we going to adapt? It's interesting. In every case that I know where there was a company that ran into difficulty, like Nokia or Polaroid, it was early on enough that the company could have recognized that. So, for example, Nokia, the difficulty they had, it was that their business strategy was to compete on features on phones. And finally, this is when Stephen Elop, who was the head of Nokia, said, our competitors are taking our market share, not with devices. He says they're taking them with entire ecosystems. That is to say, a larger community of developers, applications, and we just can't sell phones based on features. And that was evident, by the way, many years before Nokia ran into trouble. One of the indications of that was certainly at MIT, there were people who wanted to do their own computing. There were very radical people here who said, that was Richard Stallman, who was at CSAIL here at MIT, who felt strongly that you have to be able to control your own software and what you're writing, because otherwise you're being controlled by big companies. That was his. So there's a whole community out there of people who wanted to write their own stuff. And so that is something I think Apple capitalized on with apps. Now people could write their own. And so the iPhone became a platform for a platform business. And that's what people talk about today, are platform businesses. So again, I think that as a company, you want to explore broadly. You want to bring in a group of people. You have to debrief. And the time is on your side to see how the world is changing. Because, you know, if it doesn't show up for another 5 years, you can still do something to adapt.
Awesome. So we've got questions already coming in, so I'm going to put aside my questions and hopefully we can come back to them at the end. But I know people are chomping at the bit to hear your perspective on a few things here. So the first one is, you know, what do you think of the venture client model serving as early clients with startups instead of CVC?
Okay, let me look at the questions. Okay, I would say, I think that's fine. For example, MIT ILP has the MIT Startup Exchange. And that's an opportunity for companies to learn about what people are doing. And then if they want to go off and they want to be a client of the company to explore, that's fine to do that. But I would say, I don't think that alone means you shouldn't be doing investigation. You have to constantly be looking for that. It's just some other things to say too. You know, MIT does not create startups. It doesn't, you know, the startups are created outside of MIT. So, you know, we have an opportunity for you to learn about startups that are started by MIT people. But then I think, again, you have to explore widely to find those firms. You have to be willing to talk to a lot of different people about that. But I would say, I think that venturing model is what people are doing, is looking for to be, and if I'm understanding this correctly, the first participants with the company.
All right. And the next one is, with the open innovation approach, how do you overcome the fear of someone stealing your idea and beating you to market?
I mean, that's an interesting question. Okay. Because you know what that says? I think it says, it's saying that somebody wants to discuss their idea with somebody like at a university, right? So they're kind of looking for maybe like consulting. Am I right in asking that that's what they want, why they want to talk about their idea?
I'm free to jump in, Tom, if you want to clarify.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, not even just that, but I mean, in order to flesh out, when you're exploring, you know, new areas in digital technology, you want to be talking with a lot of people in your industry and people are doing the same thing, right? And it's very easy to kind of run off and tell them everything that you're thinking about doing. And I think it's important to have that collaboration, but if you're doing that, then, you know, that idea percolates out there and maybe someone else comes up with it and comes up with a better mousetrap and beats your pants, right?
Well, yeah, the only thing I can say to this is that, for example, we don't have NDAs that are broad NDAs. Somebody comes in, whatever they say is top secret. And the reason you're asking like a really important question point. A university only does three things. They teach courses that are state of the art. They do groundbreaking research. But the thing that makes it work is discourse, that people are in an exchange of ideas and opinions. I think it's certainly possible to be part of that exchange of ideas and opinions without discussing necessarily a product idea. Mm-hmm. Certainly at a university, that would be, I think, the case, that one would be able to learn about technologies that are developing. In fact, I can tell you about ones that I would say people ought to be finding out about right now, because they'll be affecting every business. But I think what you're describing is something like if you went to a conference and people start talking over a beer and then they start...
IRI or whatever else, it's important for innovation, for ideas to, you know, mingle, right? Where do you draw the line, right? And it's so easy to be too open.
That may be the case. But see, I think too, the question is, if you're discussing your idea, what are you hoping to gain from the conversation? If it's somebody's going to talk about improve my idea, well, maybe, maybe you want to be more careful that way. And I don't know how to control a thing like that. I think you have to be part of the discourse, though, of what's going on.
My feeling on this is that, yes, you have to be careful with what you disclose, but you can't be too closed off. People may come up with the same idea as you anyway, right? And so you just have to trust in your ability to make it to market and to do well, right? And let the chips fall where they may, I think. But
yeah, I think you're right. That makes sense. I'm also going to say, I think the more that one can be exposed to outside thinking and ideas in a wide range of things, the better the ideas you'll have yourself. You know, I'm reminded of something that a performer named John Carney wrote in a book, and this is for magicians. And this is what he gave as advice. He advised professional magicians to go to concerts, to go to museums, to be exposed to all kinds of cultural influences, because he said it will make your performance better. It'll make it more sophisticated. And so that's why you want to immerse oneself in this, is because all of these influences will cause a person to have a better idea in the end. So
I agree. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Got a follow-up from Jaap de Vries from FM Global, who asked about the corporate venture capitalism. So he says, I totally agree with the goal to bring back information and integrating with the community that is creating something. What would be the best way to sell this idea to corporate leadership, since ROIs on this would be vague? That's a tough one.
That's a very tough one. Also, that's a very deep question, in my opinion. And I'm going to say why I think this is like a very deep question. What I see that is frustrating in a company, and I wrote a paper about this some time ago called Should Accounting Be the Language of Business? And when I wrote that article, I quoted a professor who was very famous at the University of Chicago, an accounting professor, I remember, who told a very large group of MBA students, accounting is the language of business. I heard that language. I said, I think that it's terminology. But then I realized, then I was talking to a colleague here Ken Goldman, who taught English in Russia. You know, he spoke many languages. And he said, you know, people say that when they speak a certain language, they take on another persona. They start thinking differently. And certainly for example, in German has words that you cannot translate into English, that are concepts that you have to think in German to really understand what somebody means. And also, languages that don't have words for certain concepts, they don't have the concept. So that was something that was studied. Or for example, the Finns have a word in Finnish for striving that is not translatable into English. Okay, and it's such a word that you can't speak English and understand what a person from Finland means, okay, if they use that word. So the trouble with accounting is it assumes its own language. Everything has to be turned into a number. And the problem with innovation is that innovation is often about a difference of opinion about how to do that. This is the case that happened with COVID vaccines. So the COVID vaccines that are based on mRNA technology, originally that was sort of, I don't want to say disparaged, but people didn't think it would have any promise. There was a difference of opinion. It wasn't a number. Whereas the accounting people are looking for a number, and there aren't words for things. There is no concept for like user experience. You know, it's like you're going to get nowhere talking about user experience to an accountant. So I think companies have to realize that that everything cannot be reduced to accounting language. They have to be able to weigh what's being heard. That's why I think Jim Eichner had written that you need to be able to tell stories. Maybe in selling an idea, the big thing would be to say, I see Schadenfreude. As a word, but maybe what you have to do is to scare people with what the impact would be. You know, can you imagine if everybody had this or that? One of the big things that stands in the way of innovation, in my opinion, is a lack of imagination. So John Stuart Mill, who wrote On Liberty, you may have read that when you were in college. It's about liberty of thought. But it has a lot of very good quotes in it. One of them he said was that the one thing the unoriginal mind can imagine no use for is originality. So you know, it matters who is running the company, and do they see things as like an existential threat if they don't do something? I certainly will say this too. I think that if you were to speak to MIT people or go to a conference, so much of the research is directed at changing how we live. I'll give you an example. And there's a technology that's like this is CubeSats. So this is a little satellites. And I remember we did a conference in Vienna, Austria about this, and Professor Carrie Cahoy was the professor presenting this. And she started out her presentation, this was really crazy, with a spy photograph from the CIA of Long Beach, California. And she said, you know, it takes like 21 days for the satellite to keep coming back to show you this dock area. And then she showed ones from privately launched satellites. But the difference was there were different pictures of cars in the parking lot. It was over a 7-day period. And the point was with technology that was available, you know, not through the CIA, you could have spy photographs every day of a location that were high resolution. Okay, so that kind of a picture can impress people. Or a different example, I recall a Professor Oliva was speaking about an artificial intelligence problem. But the way she spoke about it was with a movie. And it was a little kid who was with his mother. And I say little kid, he was an infant. And he was watching a man trying to open a book cabinet, but he was laden with books. So he kept bumping into the doors, trying to open it. And finally, the little boy walks up and he opens the door for him. He caught up. And she said, we can't make a robot that can do that, but that's what we want to do. So this is what sold Media Lab, by the way, is demos. That's, you know, that it was demo or die was this expression at Media Lab. Instead of showing somebody a graph, what they do is they demo the technology. A lot of those demos ended up being things that you have today. So if I were a company and you wanted to sell an idea and you have to get around this ROI thing, you want to remember, I think was it Marshall McLuhan had said that all new technology appears to be magic because it's so incredible. So maybe to sell your idea, do you have a demo that is compelling? Because people make decisions emotionally. They don't just make decisions on numbers. But I would think that a compelling demo would be, that's what like a TED talk is like. What would that be like? Maybe that's a way to convince people. Depends on the management and the company too.
Does that help you out?
Yeah, no, that's very much in line. We actually came in, our innovation team actually got some counseling from a former Broadway actor about how to tell stories better, you know, both outwardly facing and inwardly facing to each other, to stakeholders in the company, because especially me as sort of a technical former researcher, I would be like, oh, the numbers make sense. Why don't people get it, right? So,
yeah.
And then another one of our mottos of our innovation team is what we say called prototype it. So that's right to your point of showing a demo, if it's wicked dirty, but showing it. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. Thank you.
Yeah. It was interesting. There's a faculty member, Michael Davies, who is works with strategy. And he said the interest he has is in companies not that are, let's say, Google and not startups, although he's consulted for both, but rather he said the companies that are very well established where there's a lot of inertia going on. And so in talking about that, he was saying what you want to be careful about what you say. He said, you should never use the word pilot. Because he said, if you say something's been piloted, they think it's going to be scale upable, right? It's a pilot. So he said, you have to describe those things as experiments and you have to convince the management of the need to do experiments.
Right.
One other thing he also mentioned is he said, it's very hard to innovate off of a core business. Because it's got so many constraints. A lot of times you have to do something I don't want to use the word adjacent because people use that in marketing adjacencies. I don't mean it that way. But something that is alongside of the business for the new area of growth, because it may not be easy to do it within the core of the business because people are so, you know, it's so well established and there's so much inertia going in one direction. So much history with things. Other questions? These are very interesting points of view.
So if no one else jumps in, I definitely still have some. So, but we'll give everyone a second here.
Yeah.
So I'll jump in then. So, you know, what are some of the technologies that you think are going to have a big impact in the next few years?
Okay. Well, I wrote a article about that for IRI called Storm Warning. You might want to look at it, but I'll reiterate what they are. There are four of them I would worry about, and I'd worry about them for a reason. It's because they all integrate together and because there's a lot of energy behind them. See, that's another thing. When you seek to innovate, you want on a campus, where's the energy? Where are people talking? You know, okay, so there are four of these. One is low Earth orbiting satellites. The second is digital twins. The third is lithionics and neuromorphic computing. And the last is 2D materials. Now, why are these important? Well, low Earth orbiting satellites are what we just talked about as CubeSats. That will be important for telecommunications anywhere in the world. And actually, the United States and China are in a big race around this topic. And this is all being done by private companies in the United States, but people are launching satellites to use up orbits so that other people can't have those orbits going forward. But this will have a very, very major impact on logistics, communications, huge. Digital twins, because this is emerging as something that will be very important to companies in this way, in a number of ways. One is that it will change business models. So for example, one of our faculty members who has worked with digital twins pretty extensively has said that in the future, if you were like a truck manufacturer, you may not make any trucks, but you may lease a model of a digital twin to people who do make trucks. So maybe a way to think about that is it's like saying on iPhone, you know, Apple doesn't have any manufacturing facilities for iPhones, but it leases that out to other people. So digital twins are going to be a very, very big topic. And there are faculty members that I know that are talking about not just using it to monitor something, but rather using it in the design process of designing products as well. So this, you know, you can make a digital twin of all kinds of things. We have a faculty member, Joe Paradiso at Media Lab, who created a digital twin of an environmental area. It's a marsh with, you know, birds and plants. So it's possible to make a digital twin of pretty much anything, I think. Now, lithionics and neuromorphic computing will be a very big deal. This is about what are called memristors. And I think that this is a lithium-based technology, which means that there will be computation that more imitates human brain synapses. And the reason this is important is for energy usage, data storage, and speed all will increase, but it'll involve a different kind of mathematics. But the expectation is that this will be a very big revolution in computation. And 2D materials, a big area that will develop in this is in tiny sensors. So there's a faculty member here at MIT, Dr. Palacios, and this is really crazy. He was speaking to a company about this and it was like jaw-dropping to listen to this. He said, I don't want to sense a million things outside of this room. I want to sense a million things inside. And then he showed a sensor that you could put on a penny, but it was so small that if you look at an American penny and there's a you know, Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial, it would sit on his lap. It was so tiny. So we're talking about things that could even be airborne sensors. But the thing with 2D materials that was the big breakthrough was his development of a antenna so that you could power sensors with Wi-Fi signals. But he was saying there are going to be trillions of sensors and billions of devices. And, you know, just to think going forward on that, I was astounded. I read an article that Thomas Friedman wrote, and I think he was talking about the war in Ukraine and about people having information about what's going on. And he said, half of the world's population has smartphones. Can you imagine half the world's population having smartphones? That's unbelievable. So all of these technologies I've just mentioned, the satellites, the digital twins, the lithionics, the neuromorphic computing, those are new kind of computer chips, 2D materials. This is going to be really big stuff that'll affect many different businesses. So like even if you're like sports equipment, it'll affect what you're doing. It'll affect, you know, if you're in the restaurant business, it's going to affect what you're doing. I mean, think about it. Now when you go to a restaurant, they don't give you a menu. They give you a QR code. And, you know, that's just the beginning. There's going to be a time when people are going to say, remember when they used to give you a QR code and you know, paper menus, that's going to be like memorabilia. So things are really going to change. So those are the big four that I think, among others, but those are the big four.
Oh, yeah. There's so much to think about.
Yeah.
I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I'm still trying to get over the whole QR code instead of a paper menu
thing. Yeah, I know. That's kind of an adjustment, certainly for me.
Not a fan. But so we'll wrap up here. We're at time. So I just want to give a huge thank you to you, Randall, for sharing your insights, sharing your hour with us. We really appreciate it. And I know the attendees really enjoyed it too, and everyone who listens later too. And also thank you for writing for RTM. I'll share some of the articles that you referenced here. I'll make sure that everyone gets a chance to see those. And we'll see you in the next issue of in whatever next issue of RTM you're in. I struggle to keep up with who's in what one, but I look forward to seeing your next article.
That's great. I really appreciate that. And I really enjoyed speaking with everybody. You know, I was going to say, if you have any questions or thoughts, you can email me at rwright@mit.edu. And so, you know, very happy to hear from any of you. And actually, you know, I don't know how many of you are part of the MIT ILP program, but I would say, I think it's a fantastic way to really connect it to the future. So happy to talk about that too, if it's of interest.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Randall. We really appreciate it.
Okay, right.
Thank you for attending. Thanks, everyone. Have a good afternoon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.